Well, good afternoon. I have a confession to make. Those of us who've been in California for any length of time, we have been praying for rain. So it has arrived, even if it's just a little bit. But we are so thankful to have the moisture, even though we need much, much more. We are so glad that you're part of this conversation. There's been a lot of great topics covered. There's been some frustration in that, boy, there's so much more to talk about than what we've been able to sort of reach for at the edges. But we are talking about, I think, some important things here about our churches. We have tried to bring challenging conversations to the table. So we don't expect to resolve everything, but we do expect to raise the questions. And I have been pleased by the conversations that have lingered in this room after we've met the last couple of days and those that have carried on and moved out. So we are just grateful for your participation in this conversation. For those of you who are with us for the first time, my name is Rick Gibson. I'm Vice President for Public Affairs, Church Relations here at Pepperdine. The Church Relations team leads the Bible lectures, and I hope you've enjoyed them this year. My job today is to lead us through introduce a conversation. Jason Locke, who is from the Fresno Church of Christ, the College Church of Christ in Fresno, is going to engage a panel over a topic, and then we're going to open it up for conversation. And my job is to try to keep you all engaged in that conversation. So that's what we'll be doing today. So the first day, we asked ourselves, what is it like to reach millennials? And we probably raised more questions than we answered, but we began to really address some of that. And then we wanted to know and discuss yesterday, what is it like to partner? What is it like to be more ecumenical? We even learned how to spell ecumenical and define ecumenical. What is it like to be more ecumenical and to partner with other fellowships, other believers, other faiths for the glory of God? And where does that work? Where do we struggle with that? That's one of those conversations, Jason, where I think we kind of danced around the edges. We really talked around how that might work around service, when we serve together. But we have much more to think about when it comes to actually partnering together in other ways. Well, today, when Jason and I were talking about the themes for this class, we wondered what to title this one. I don't think we came up with a snazzy marketing title for this one, and because it was about systems and infrastructure. What do you do with the blessing and curse of infrastructure? And so, what do we mean by that? We're all in churches where we've inherited buildings, communities, practices, ways of doing things, systems, whatever it may be. And they were created for maybe a different time, for a different group of people, different set of circumstances. But here we are, needing to somehow live with those and deal with those. For years, I was a member at the Newland Street Church. John and Jackie, you were there for years. That was a church that was in Garden Grove. Still is in Garden Grove, exactly where it was. But there's almost nothing about the immediate community around it that is the same as it was when I was there just 20 years ago. And by the way, I remember serving on the Lord's Supper one Sunday, the table one Sunday, and there were nearly 1,000 people there. Wasn't that long ago. But boy, that community changed dramatically. And the question is, how do you react to that? How committed are you to the zip code and the address and all that? So today we're going to talk a little bit about what does it mean to deal with the things that we've inherited. I sat in on a class one time. I think I mentioned this to you all. I sat into a class one time that Rick Warren was leading years ago around church growth. And we were talking about this very issue. And I remember this line stuck with me. I would have tweeted it if we were on Twitter back then, but we weren't. But he had this great little line. He said, look, I've seen your buildings. I'm thinking of starting an arson ministry. Because he was saying some of these things just kind of need to go. They need to move. They just, you know, he didn't mean that seriously. But, I mean, it was just, look, we've got to sometimes start a fresh witness in our communities. And so how do we do that? And so that's the topic for today. It's bigger than the 45 minutes that we have, but we're going to give it a try. We have another panelist who is on his way. And he'll come in when he comes in. But in the meantime, Jason Locke, who's going to continue to be our facilitator of our conversation today is going to introduce those that we do have. So, Jason, welcome, and thanks for the last couple of days. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick. It's great to have this opportunity to talk about these important subjects. For the next 20 minutes or so, I'll lead the conversation and then pitch it back to Rick for some maybe broader conversation with you guys as well, to engage the panelists yourselves or just to share some feedback. But this, in my mind, is probably the most important and the most rich of the 3 days of material. Now, I know that this crowd is the smallest. It's Friday. And the title is a little boring, perhaps. It's my fault. I'll take the blame for that one. But I know that a number of people will listen in to this podcast. So just know that this is a really important conversation. And I value this as a church leader in California as seeing that this is probably even more important than the conversation about millennials, because I think some of the reason we can't reach millennials is because of inflexibility with infrastructure. And some of the challenge we have in being ecumenical sometimes is because we have certain things and certain ways of doing things that are hard to change. I was talking with a pastor friend in urban Chicago. He's got a congregation that's been there for decades. The neighborhood has changed a lot since the congregation began. And when it began, the church members may have all lived fairly close there to the building and would have been a bigger church back in that day and time. But now, those folks who are longer-term members, who are more well-to-do now, they all live elsewhere in Chicago. And they drive in for their church services. And that's about half of the church. The other half of the congregation is folks who actually live in the neighborhood, but they now belong to the hardscrabble poor of that neighborhood. And so you have a building, and you have resources and know-how, but it belongs to people who live elsewhere, who really don't have time or availability to do stuff around the building very much. But the people who do live there in the neighborhood, they don't have know-how or resources, but they're there. Then I have another friend who's in the Bronx who planted a church a number of years ago. And he has, through hard work and Lord's provision, has been able to start a community of faith there. He's got people, most of them who come from the hardscrabble poor in the Bronx neighborhood where he himself lives and works. But it's a new church. They don't have a building. They don't have people among the church with resources to even begin to dream of purchasing a building. They don't have people among the community with a lot of skills and know-how or resources to do much. So he's got people who are flexible to do whatever, but he doesn't have the resources. He doesn't have the infrastructure that my friend in Chicago has, but sometimes has some challenges maybe using that infrastructure. And so I think that might be a fitting segue to our conversation with our panelists today. And our third panelist, Fade Haygood, he's had just a challenging, I think, day. Lost a real key member of his church here in urban L.A. So I don't know if he's coming from something dealing with that. But anyway, when Fade gets here, we'll introduce him. John Reed preaches for the Hilltop Church in El Segundo. And Andy Wall is preaching minister at Conejo Valley up in Thousand Oaks. And I think all three of these churches here in Fate Preaches Metropolitan Church in Carson, all three of these churches I think have started in maybe different circumstances, different eras even, and have different perspectives perhaps on infrastructure. So time's limited. We want to be able to have conversation here, but also with you guys as well. So I just want to ask each of you briefly share the size of your congregation and the facilities you currently have. Let's just think about facilities here right at the very beginning as entry point.
So we average on Sunday morning for our worship between 160 to 200 on a given Sunday at this time. We are in El Segundo. The building that we're in was built in 1953. We are no longer in our building. So we are worshiping in a middle school because we outgrew the building, was too small for the growth that we were experiencing over the last 10, 15 years. So we have moved. We still own our building and could talk about what we're doing with that, but we're worshiping in a middle school and have had to wrestle with pros and cons of what that looks like.
So I'm at the Kaneo Valley Church. The congregation has been there since the early 70s, basically corresponding to when Pepperdine University moved to Malibu. A lot of the people working at Pepperdine couldn't afford to live in Malibu, and so Thousand Oaks became the nearest affordable area, and so a congregation pretty quickly sprung up there. A building was built by, I think, 1977, 1978. The goal was always that the building was basically a worship facility with some classroom space, and the idea was very quickly there would be an education building that would be built. Well, it's been 35 plus years and several attempts. I won't rehearse that sad history here, but there were several attempts that never went anywhere. And so we have been in a building without a fellowship hall. Our fellowship hall our kitchen is as big as this front pew. It's a little closet off to the side. And we're a church of about 260, have been as high as 325. So that's a very interesting challenge to us. So we are, our youth group has to walk across a four-lane road to go to the house that is there across the way that belongs to one of our ministers. We have no handicap access, so we don't have enough parking, so we feel the constraint. I know you have a different situation in where you are. You have almost too much building, but we have the opposite problem. We just feel handcuffed at every turn about in terms of the classes we're able to offer, in terms of access for different people, in terms of safety of our kids. I mean, all these different things that goes back to our building.
Fate, welcome. I know you've had, we're really sorry about the loss of one of your key members. Yeah. I heard about, so our condolences, heart goes out to you and to that family. But just briefly share size of your church, facilities that you have.
We are a church of, well, it depends, between 120 and 170. It depends. Our facility is, we are leasing space at we have converted a warehouse. And so it's a warehouse and office spaces. So it's 5,000 square feet. And we have plenty of parking.
Very good. So, and Faith has started Metropolitan Church. I mean,
yes.
You're in different shoes from John, who the church is 60, 70 years old. And Andy, your church is 40 or so years old. So there are many churches in our state. And you guys are in different positions, say, from where I would be sitting on this panel. Many churches in our state on the West Coast here who built buildings in the 60s and 70s for congregations in that day and time that no longer reflect the church of today. Maybe the church is a lot smaller than it is. Maybe it's a different church. Reflect on this problem of properties and buildings from a theological, missiological perspective. Is this a problem that's uniquely American? Is it a heritage of Christendom that we have these buildings that we need for our existence? You guys would love to have larger buildings, all of you. You don't. Some have larger buildings that they'd love to be able to have an arson ministry to pare down or just to rebuild and start over. Reflect on that. Is that just a problem of American churches? Is it a West Coast problem because property is so expensive? Where does that problem stem from?
We no longer have a zone in our city for churches. So for us to get a bigger building, a bigger facility, we would need a much larger congregation. We would need probably at least $10 million. And then we'd have to fight with the city to get a conditional use permit. And the city has flat out told us, you will not build a church here because we need revenue. It's a box. El Segundo's a little boxing community. We need property that's going to produce revenue, and churches don't because of their tax-exempt status. Theologically, for us to move out of the building was a big challenge for our church because it meant people that built the building, some of them, you know, were still there. And so to move out, we didn't move out because of we had to move out because of lack of space. We went to two services and still ran out of space again, so we had to get a bigger facility. But theologically, we had to make the decision, is being one big happy family going to be our goal, or will we continue to reach people that don't know Jesus? Because if we're going to keep reaching people that don't know Jesus, we're going to have to just find space for them, or they will find another church. So that was theologically a decision that we had to make. Are we going to be about kingdom expansion, or just being one big happy family?
Well, we had probably the reverse problem. We started out being a church that was non-located. When we started out in 2000. Since then, we have met in parks, rec centers, hotels, community centers. It's part of the miracle of our congregation, though. It's most the church experts say that kind of church lasts about 2 years. And we lasted 10 years like that. Everything from showing up at schools and the janitor didn't show, and so we had to have church in the street next to the school. And we just did it. But I say it's the reverse problem because our church is an extreme commuter church. We have a third of our church that lives at least 70 miles away. And for the last 13 years, they have driven 70 miles to church. We used to have around 70 members in the valley. We're in Carson. If you don't, you know, the valley north, that was about 45 miles away, 260 miles away. And we had about 70 members who came to the church for around 7 years in a row like that. So we were always, we started out as a cell-based church. So we had different cell segments. So having the problem of building wasn't a problem until we actually located and got a building. And so we started having the reverse problem. People started to feel, having arrived, we have a building now. And so then the mission became less as important as the location. So,
yeah, it's my sense we're always going to live in that tension. And the Christian faith is full of, you know, even theology is full of tensions. Christ is fully human. He is fully divine. That the kingdom is here, and yet it's not yet. So I think we're human beings. We have to have a space to worship in, even if it's not a building. I mean, it can be a park, it can be whatever. But we have to have a discernible place where we will go meet. You can format it lots of ways. It can be cell based. You can build a building. You can build a cathedral in Europe. You can meet in a thatched hut with no sides. Because we are physical beings, we have to be in some place. And so I was thinking about this. You know, if I was starting a church, this might be a new, or, you know, starting a new congregation, this might be a different conversation. But if you're already in an existing congregation in a facility, that decision was made 40 or 50 years, you know, ago. And so now the question is, okay, how do we need to adapt this or improve this? But it's, we can't just meet in hyperspace.
Well, that's a great point, Andy. The decisions that are made years ago are ones that we inherit. And it's not just about buildings, right? No. They tell you as a missionary, be very careful what you start, because whatever you start and how you start it is what those later Christians will be stuck with. And I'm thinking about Wednesday nights. My own church is struggling right now finally to let go of Wednesday nights. 15% of our church comes back for Wednesday nights. But it's something churches of Christ just have done. Why is it so hard for us to let go of those types of infrastructure? That's not a place. That's a meeting time. Why is it hard for us to let go of those types of things?
Well, variety. I'll throw one. I think the sense that we've had the last 15 or 20 years is that the church feels like it's retreating in society. You know, we no longer have the favored place. But, you know, it used to be people never scheduled anything that competed with church on Sunday. Now you've got, you know, drama, dance, sports, all happening on Sundays. And so it feels like, man, we keep taking these steps back. And so to take another step back or to give up another piece, you know, it's like, well, what are people going to do on Wednesday nights? Are they just going to watch TV? I'd rather hold on to it, you know. So there's this piece about, it feels like we just keep relinquishing. And so sometimes, you know, we have to say, well, no, we're not relinquishing. We're just reclaiming some other time or space. But that I think is at least in my mind, the reason why we may be resistant to giving up some things that we've had.
So the feeling that this is a part of the overall retreat and decline, that maybe why we fight against some of these things?
I mean, that's a reason.
Fate, you've had freedom to start from scratch. Why did you want to start from scratch?
Would you like him to rephrase that question?
Do you want to start from scratch again? Do you want to do that again?
I kind of feel like I need a Twix right now.
To start from scratch.
It's an awesome idea. That's a different question. I'll take the second question. Well, we've never had Wednesday night. We tried some things, but the reason we didn't do Wednesday, it wasn't because we were anti-Wednesday night. We didn't do Wednesday night because we felt that the present structures of Wednesday night were against what we were trying to purposefully do. So our whole educational program, we changed it. We had what we called Metroversity. It was more university-based type, you know. You had class 101, 102, et cetera. But there was another reason we didn't do it as a startup. It's because when you are a startup, everything costs money. So if you're going to meet someplace on Wednesday night, it costs money. If you ask me the reason I didn't do things the traditional way, the original reason was I was sick of it. I literally, because we don't have business meetings. So because when I first began the ministry, if someone asked me to come to a business meeting, I would literally start to feel sick at my stomach. I'm not exaggerating. I would literally start to feel nauseated. I just could not spend one more meeting discussing toilets. Couldn't do it. So we did a lot of things differently. Some of them were reactionary. That's the reason I tell the story, because some stuff started working, not because we were necessarily purposeful, but because we were reacting. So our infrastructures kind of sometimes grew out of our dread.
Yes. So like it or not, infrastructure grows up.
Yes.
Why is it that it's hard, though, for us to be flexible with infrastructure? John, do you want to make any comment on that?
Well, I just know that a lot of the difficulty subsided when we moved out of the building into the school. Simply by changing space, the things that people were fighting for changed as well. And I think partially they caught the vision that it's not about us. It's not about doing things the way we've always done them. And by the way, we're in a cafeteria, you know, with every holiday all over the walls. So the whole sacred space thing quickly changed when you've got, you know, black cats and bats and pumpkins all over the walls. And somehow we had to redefine sacred space and sacred time. And it was easier to do that when we left this, the building. So,
well, just one more question before I hand it back to Rick. I appreciate that, John. Another piece of infrastructure is people. I mean, sometimes it's hard to transition from the people who have been the key workers for 40 years, but maybe now are the aging superstars. See what happens to a franchise when they have aging superstars. I don't know what we're talking about here.
Hypothetically.
And ownership can't make tough decisions about empowering.
Cold-blooded.
But in what way is that, I mean, we made that comparison, right? What way is that a fitting comparison or not for our church situations?
It's an extremely appropriate illustration of our present church situation. George Barna, years and years ago when I was reading him, probably 20 years ago now, I think the book was User-Friendly Churches. And he talked about the reason many of our churches aren't user-friendly is because we are afraid to kill all the sacred cows. And we have serious, serious sacred cows. From my context, if you grew up under Hogan or if you grew up under Pitts, you know, how they did what they did, it wasn't just the doctrine that they taught, you know, but the methodology in which they used became sacred. And so if you were a young guy and you tried to do otherwise, you were not just changing what we are doing, you were literally leaving the church, you know, because you weren't doing it that way. So often I think there needs to be more boldness in allowing those who are mavericks to move us forward.
But isn't there some need for caution as well? Because sometimes some of those sacred cows do need to go. Absolutely. But sometimes some of those sacred cows are the engines that still drive some things. How do you find that balance?
Well, you have to navigate that balance. I think that's a part of leadership, because you don't want to just run people off. You want to, and it takes a lot of prayer, a lot of conversations, a lot of patience with each other, especially when things just look so different than what we're used to. And I think it takes a lot of love and a lot of grace and a lot of time.
Yeah, if something is going well, you know, I don't think that's when we think about changing it. I mean, it's obviously when it's in serious decline. And in our own congregation, interestingly, there was an opportunity that came up in a neighboring congregation about 5 years ago, a congregation that was in serious decline, almost on life support, and a group of about, I don't know, 15 or 20 of our young adult families, or young adults, decided to go and help revitalize that congregation. And so that was an interesting moment where they got to really get invested in a new ministry that was just, you know, one city over. And they were probably, you know, in retrospect, we probably weren't doing enough fresh and innovative things. And so they had a chance to kind of try those out and go to a place. And it wasn't competitive. It wasn't a split. It was, you know, we prayed and blessed and, you know, you sent them with our love. But that was a moment for me to be reflective of. I wonder if we should have added some new things while not losing the great things that we've had that are being healthy and feeding a large number in our congregation.
I had a question from that. Maybe you can answer it. But it seems like we kind of feed our addiction and our dysfunction because we put a lot of energy into maintaining those things which don't work.
Which don't work, yeah.
We know they don't work. Like you said, we're falling off. But instead of us seeking even to fix them, we seek to change our behaviors in order to make sure that those things which don't work don't die. Mm-hmm. So I don't have an answer, but I wanted to ask.
There's a class title this hour, Survival of the Sickest. It yes. sounds really interesting, I wonder what that's about.
Well, maybe that's a good segue to bring in folks who want to share something.
Thank you for this conversation. It's an important one. You can tell just how important it is. You know, you guys know, but I used to be a minister at a church a long time ago and decided for several reasons to come to Pepperdine and do something different. And then later in my career, went back to school, got an MBA, and one of the things we worked through in our program was organizational behavior, and that became a fascinating thing. I remember calling up Jeff, who I ministered with one time, and saying, man, I want another shot at ministry. I mean, I can't believe what I didn't know about organizations and how challenging it is. There's a great kind of organizational psychologist, a guy named Edgar Schein. He's a pretty smart guy. It's a pretty dry book, but he's a pretty smart guy. And it's an interesting thing. He talks about how organizations struggle to unfreeze. It's one of the hardest things they can do. It's hard enough for individuals to unfreeze. But for a collective group of people, especially when you have ghosts involved, it's very difficult to unfreeze an organization. In fact, one of the hardest things that an organization can do. And it's systems and infrastructure that make it very difficult to move. They are rigid, and somehow the people within those systems remain rigid. Getting out of that orbit is extremely difficult. And I think you're right, Jason. I do think that this is one of these topics that was that the others are even connected to. Well, let me open it up to the group. Maybe give some thought to that. I may come back to that in a moment. But you've heard a few things today. Any reactions to what you've heard today? Any questions that you have heard that you'd like to raise around the questions of infrastructure, systems, and how they impact our churches?
And while people are thinking, oh, go ahead.
You can go ahead.
We're to a new part. Go ahead.
Okay. So the thing that strikes me is that we try to preserve the family nature of the church, which means we have older people and younger people and that sort of thing. And as you said, that makes us very difficult to unfreeze, and that's a good description. And you don't want to chase people away. You don't want to lose young people. You don't want to chase old people. So you're kind of stuck. You know, being a biologist, I see evolution at work all the time. And what happens if you have an animal which is highly adapted to one situation and the weather changes, that animal dies off and another one takes over. So maybe that's the reason we're seeing churches pass on, is so that new churches can spring up that look a little different. That's kind of hard. So if we could make that a little easier, I'd like to learn how.
Interesting. Makes me think of the class title you're talking about. Yeah. You want to share your comment, Andy?
We moved past it.
Okay. Thank you for that, by the way. I think that's insightful. Other questions, comments around these systems? Are any of you experiencing something similar or something different that you might be able to share? Tell us about the Costa Mesa Church. Here, John. This is for our audience online.
The Costa Mesa Church had several years ago, a really good preacher named Andy Wall. And then he left and the church went downhill ever since. But, I'm sorry. No, just kidding online. So, you know, our demographics have changed, there within our city. In the 70s, Hispanic was 18%. Now it's 52-53% in our community. We're looking at kicking some tires and trying to think how, instead of coming from a place of weakness, are we going to keep the doors open versus are we going to sell the building and relaunch and have a, not necessarily a new identity, but really kind of a new identity to reach our community. And the leadership structure is critical in all that. How do we get rid of those sacred crosses? When you've had a building for over, 50 years there? Pretty close. How do you say, well, this isn't our identity anymore here in Costa Mesa? And we feel like a lot of them will probably feel like, hey, we're giving up. And in actuality, we're trying to keep the legacy going. So we're trying to ask those questions, and we're kicking tires right now to see what is the best way to do that and to bring life and impact the community. And so they're tough decisions to make in that situation. So.
Yes.
With a problem being like a lack of infrastructure, lack of meeting places kind of thing, or churches closing down, do you think that we might be on a, to follow the biologist's comment, that we might be on the verge of a possibility of churches starting to play well together and maybe even merge? Do we see that as a possibility maybe in California?
Yes. The scary part about it is that I don't think the mergers are kingdom driven. I think many of the mergers are becoming survival driven. And I was just thinking, I've listened to the comments, you know, how do we define us, you know, and we, when we say those terms, are we the kingdom of God? Are we meant to take land for God? Or are we us family? I.e., therefore I need to make sure that the kids are right and the elderly are right. You know, how we define we is going to be very important. And so the mergers that I have seen have not been because, well, this is the best thing for the kingdom. The mergers I have seen, at least locally, have been, okay, let me see if I can eat this other church so we won't die. So, I mean, I don't know. But I am suspect of our motivation for doing it.
I've seen an example in Orange County that happened about 15 years ago where a Christian church and a Church of Christ, historic Church of Christ, many, right, many years is the place my wife and I were married, merged. And I know there was some fallout in that process, but it seems like that has been, I think the outcome is still going strong. They still have a vibrant ministry in Irvine. I mean, so there, I can think of positive examples of churches, you know, coming together. One church has, you know, people and leadership and social capital. Another church has a great facility, you know, in a growing area maybe. And so there's, you know, I don't know if you would call that a marriage of convenience, but sometimes that might be a kingdom opportunity. So I think I can think of some positive examples in that without negating Faith's comment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have two live examples that are both reflective of Faith's and yours, Andy. And the one I was thinking of was, I think there's Stone Creek now, right?
Uh,
Creekside, okay. They did change an identity. But there's a pretty healthy witness there and a fellowship there. There's another one in Riverside where this is happening right now in a pretty profound way. And it's not so much even a matter of right motives. It is they are out of choices. I mean, they are being driven to something else. And it is a consolidation. And consolidation itself should be something that does worry us. We should be seeing some kind of expansion. You know, and I think we are certainly seeing some consolidation. I don't know if you've read it's not like it's great, easy, enjoyable reading, bedtime reading, but if you've read the 21st Century Christians new directory and some of the statistics around that, it's a pretty sobering read, just the first few pages of that. And you can see consolidation happening. Let me ask the question about go back to the one I raised a moment ago about ghosts, spirits, you know, founders, leaders, others from the past, people you can no longer even engage, or groups of people you can no longer engage over these issues, but their presence is really there. Is that real at all for anybody? Shine says it's a big deal. Is that real for anybody in their churches? Yes? No?
Process.
Yeah,
it's very real.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'll talk for John for a second.
All right.
John had a little easier time in moving out of the church building because his grandpa helped build it. And so, you know, that wouldn't you say that was helpful because you were connected to him?
Yeah,
because they would say, you know, you had the most invested because your family put this together. So if he's willing to leave this, then why would we not?
Interesting.
The ghost,
legacy is a big deal.
It is. Yeah. The ghosts that we fought, I don't know if this is along the same lines, but first of all, we had people that just said, you know, we've never done it that way before, that type of a ghost. But then these stakeholders that were very threatened by what the church might become as we took on a new vision. And at some point, some families just said, you know, we can't go in that direction, but it hurts every time, you know, that somebody leaves. I remember getting, you know, multiple phone calls that, you know, we just can't support this. And every family, you know, that leaves, that it hurts. But yet, if that vision, if it's driven by a vision and a mission for reaching the lost in your community, and that's the only thing that matters, then some of those ghosts, as hard as it is, you got to just let go by the wayside.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Yeah.
Another way we've dealt with ghosts is by trying to show honor to them, even though we're adapting in a new way. And so 12 years ago, we had an in-depth conversation about gifts in the church and about including our sisters more in our corporate worship services. And one of the ways that we grappled with ghosts, and these are good people who went before me. I mean, Carl Mitchell, I mean, he was, you know, one of the founding leaders of the congregation. Love him and still honor him. What we tried to express was, we feel like we have gone back to Scripture. We are still students of the Word. We are still trying to honor the teaching and the spirit of the New Testament church. And we somehow neglected examples and teachings in the New Testament that seemed to green light a greater participation that, you know, for a variety of reasons, the previous generation just didn't hone in on. And so we tried to say, we are still trying to honor the biblical faithfulness and the impulse to honor you know, those biblical examples, maybe some that we overlooked. And so that way of dealing with the ghost is by saying, we do honor them, but we're seeing some things that maybe they missed.
Yeah.
And so there was an attempt to appreciate the past and not just to cut it off.
Just real quick to follow up on that, the ghosts tend to fall when you're reaching people that don't know Jesus Christ. We have a big recovery ministry at our church. And the first people to come alongside these people that are coming out of addiction were those who had these, you know, strong feelings, but they let them go because they saw these people totally out of their box finding salvation in Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Much easier to get over that.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, two statements. One of my mentors, he taught here. His name is Kenwood DeVore. And one of the things Kenwood said is that it is easier to make an impression in wet cement than it is to take a jackhammer to old concrete. And Arne Hogan said the baptistry can cure all church problems.
Yeah.
What I would say is this is 15 years ago when I was kind of unceremoniously booted from a former ministry, I was sitting in one of our final congregational meetings, and it had become like Jerry Springer. It was just ridiculous. But I was sitting there, and I got this epiphany, and I said to myself, you know what, Fate? These people don't have a problem. They love this. You have the problem. I think sometimes we have to come to the place where we stop blaming those who want ministry in a certain way or paradigm. Bless them, help them, because they can reach people in the kingdom that perhaps you can't. And perhaps it's time for those who see differently to not divide the church, but to keep spreading the kingdom by like John said, reaching those who this other generation cannot reach. I don't think there needs to be this competition between the two. Yes, I can come to Pepperdine, and yes, I can hear Sarah speak. Whether I agree with the complementarian or the egalitarian side of it or not, without trying to tear up the church, or I can also go to, I hope this doesn't get me in trouble, probably will, but I can also go to the Fried Hardeman lectures and hear them tell me that, you know, women should be barefoot and in the kitchen, and not tear up the church behind it, and still love them as my brothers. Maybe there has to come a time when we are as forgiving of those who disagree with us without putting away our kingdom agenda,
yeah,
and move on as a community of faith.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
I'm going to change hats a little bit and talk about another thing that I've observed, and that is that maybe we need to do just what's right and realize that people behind us were trying to do right, and the people in front of us may find things that are different that are right. But I would encourage us to make right decisions. Part of the reason I'm saying that is that several families who have said to us, we just can't deal with the changes that you're making. It's too much. We're going to leave. And so they leave, and where do they go? They go to a church that has instrumental music and a band and stuff like that. And I talked to one of them that I know pretty well. I said, what in the world were you thinking of? He said, there's certain things you expect in the Church of Christ, and you're not it. So I'm going to go someplace else. I don't expect him to be like Church of Christ, and I can deal with him. So I think what that says is that people are a lot more flexible than maybe we give them credit for, and we just need to think about what's right and do what's right.
And isn't it interesting? They show more grace to strangers than they do to their own church family.
It's funny. I only laugh and wince at the same time. I mean, we're going through the very same thing here at the university. You know, I mean, Mike and I, even as we think about what Bible Lectures is, has been, this is the 72nd year, we say, you know, and we try to hold on to that legacy, and we want to, but we also recognize that there is an entire segment of people yet to be reached that could be and that could benefit from, but this thing would look different, you know, and so, I mean, all organizations, large, small, deal with it. I'm working right now with the Boy Scouts of America. They are trying to figure out what to do next. And it's interesting how legacy organizations really do struggle. And we're in a moment where sort of deinstitutionalized thinking is just putting significant pressure on anything that is institutional. So... Jason, I remember at Renew, you come from a very mission-driven, the college church is even named and is a very mission-driven, has a mission-driven legacy that you still live with, right?
Yes. I mean, ostensibly it was built to be by the Fresno State campus and to
right.
be but we have very few Fresno State students today and no intentional outreach on the campus. So talking about renewing mission and letting go of the nostalgia for the past and retooling for the ministry of the future is a challenge in any context. And I think this is a great conversation. I would love to expand it some more.
Yeah. I wonder
wonder how, I mean, I really do reflect on your comment about just do the right thing. What was it? If it's in the baptistry, it solves all problems, or, you know, I think of Sarah's comment yesterday, for in the name of God, just pick one.
Pick a neighbor.
You know, just pick a need. In other words, this idea of just being mission driven, letting the, where the mission is strong enough in some way or another. I mean, another guy, not Shine, but a guy named Peter Senge said there's nothing on earth more powerful than a shared vision of the future. And that's challenging for us.
Sometimes you can't picture, you can't solve the whole, you can't solve the whole puzzle, but you can at least agree to
pick up anchor and to leave port and trust the Lord to begin to start to steer. Right. Maybe that's all we can decide on. We just have to pick up anchor somehow,
yeah,
and begin to move.
We are out of time today with a couple more minutes. Any key takeaways, anything that you may have heard, anything that you might think of as, you know, I'll take this with me. Yes? No? Okay.
I like the idea that all those that are coming together to figure out a way, but what I haven't heard was there's six generations from our elders to our keikis. Each one plays an important role. The thing I haven't heard is how you teach them. Okay, that's one thing. But the thing is feelings are hurt because our elders refuse to let go because of tradition. Our young ones don't want to listen because they've been forced to. And you put a burden on them, young ones. How do you expect them to act? They want to hear music. They want to bang their cymbals. They want to raise their voices to their God of their understanding. Our elders are teaching us tradition. And they're very proud. And I understand them. But they are old school. Our youngsters want to live their lives. And we raise them up so that they could live their lives. I have not heard that. But remember, gentlemen, brothers and sisters, there's six generations. And the thing is, nobody wants to hurt each other's feelings. Because there's a lot of feelings behind this. We love our God. We serve our God the best way we know how. But yet, we still at odds with each other because coming from an old way of life, I'll tell you what hurts the most. The truth about hurting our elders as well as our youngsters. So if we can get past our egos and what we've been taught, streets or otherwise. God says love one another, okay? Get on with the loving. But remember, there's six generations here today. How do we show honor to our elders? And how do we embrace our keikis? And our keikis in Hawaiian mean our little ones. Because there's six generations from our elders to our babies. That's, gentlemen, is what we got.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Well, thank you so much for being a part of the conversation. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your comments today. Obviously, a lot more to discuss. And so, but we thank you for engaging us this year. And we'll find ways for us to continue this conversation in the days to come. So blessings to you for the rest of the day. And we'll be seeing you around campus. Thank you.